Iquitos. Actually, there is an underwater city. 2 days after we left Manaus, we found ourselves canoeing through it. The swelling river had claimed half of Belén, the first and half of the second floor of the Bar Don Freddy, the bottom floors of the cement and steel dental clinic, the lower half of a giant billboard advertising Inca Cola, the dirt streets, the wooden bridges, the bottom floors of the stilt houses, the people's gardens, all were underwater. Electric street lamps poked up from the river like the craned necks of the black water birds called anhingas. Farther away from shore, where the houses are made of salvaged tin and plywood and thatched with yarina palm, sticks thin as a child's wrist held tangles of electric wires powering naked light bulbs inches from the water's surface. No dolphins live here, but people do. During the months that the rains flood half their town with the river's wet embrace, some 40,000 people crowd into the topmost floors of homes and restaurants and little stores, rising on stilts from the brown waters of the Amazon. Their chickens and pigs and dogs retreat up here too, like residents of Noah's Ark, and people grow vegetables and flowers in potted gardens until the water retreats and they can descend to the ground once again. Meanwhile, the people climb up and down wooden ladders to and from their canoes, and the youngest children splash in the river as if it were a suburban backyard, the girls' frilly dresses plastered wet to their skins. The older children, wearing blue and white uniforms, paddle to the secondary school. At recess, they play soccer in a classroom, because the soccer field is under 20 feet of river. Iquitos, of which Belén is a part, receives 120 inches of rain a year, more than any other city in Peru. When authors Brian Kelly and Mark London visited a decade ago, they found the place had the feeling of a lifeboat, crowded with people and jammed against the jungle wall. One good rain, we felt, and the whole sodden city might slip away, they wrote. In the early 1980s, the city was shrinking yearly, as the Amazon, meandering westward, chewed chunks from the banks during the rainy season. In the last decade, the river has begun instead to cut a deep channel to the east of the city proper. But Belén, its drowning slum, grows each year as poor people come from the countryside, seduced by the prospect of money and the promise of civilization in Peru's largest jungle city. The underwater city of Belén is no encant. Salesmen paddle door to door offering tomatoes, fish, cigarettes, cola, and the ubiquitous rice dish cooked with chicken or pork and wrapped in ginger-scented leaves. They stop at the houses where the women are washing their laundry in waters over which their own latrines are perched, the same water in which their children are swimming, the same water they drink unboiled, despite the public health warnings billboarded everywhere. Cholera is a disease we can avoid, urges a UNICEF poster in Spanish. But of course, most of the people who live here, like roughly half the population of Peru, can't read, and some of those who can refuse to boil the water anyway. But boiling it will kill all the life in the water, one health worker recalled a client had protested. Though Iquitos as a whole is said to contain 328,000 people, no one even knows how many really live here. Most of them are poor. Many would rather not be counted. Like the Ancont, Iquitos swallows people. But many here want to be swallowed. They are seduced not by enchanted dolphins, but by an underworld of a different kind. Iquitos swirls with seductions, a muddy whirlpool of need and greed, driven by poverty, passion, and whispered rumor, by displaced people and unfulfilled dreams. No roads, no telephones, no radio. That's for me, said Jamie R., who now runs a spacious, high-ceilinged restaurant on the waterfront. He decided this 18 years ago when he arrived in Iquitos. It's the capital of the huge jungle province of Loreto, an area of 14,241 square miles, larger than Spain or Germany, but with no paved roads penetrating its forest. Like many Iquitos residents, Jamie came here to escape from something else. In this case, his wife. Expat gringos tell tall tales in the bars about their jungle exploits, and workers with the dozen jungle tour companies and the 38 registered non-governmental conservation and foreign aid groups spread rumors about their competitors' dark sins. In the dry season, we'd heard, the place is full of gringos like us. Tourism declined a bit in the early 1990s when many Western nations issued travelers' advisories warning of Shining Path terrorists and bandits, though there was never a single recorded terrorist act in the province of Loreto. Mainly, they stuck to the overland route from Lima to Cuzco. Another deterrent was that Fawcett Airlines, the only company with direct flights to Iquitos from Miami, had a reputation for crashing its planes into the Andes. Bankrupted by fines, the company folded shortly after our return flight from Peru. But since Peru was removed from the traveler's advisory list in 1993, tourism has rebounded. Today, some 30,000 foreign tourists and 73,000 Peruvians visit the region each year, for it's the gateway to Peru's Amazonian jungle. Its enchantment beckons adventurers of all sorts. Some come to kayak, some come to count birds, some come to meet Indians, some come to watch monkeys, some come to take home blowguns and monkey teeth necklaces. Some come to immerse themselves in the keening calls of the jungle night. They come in search of forest primeval. They come in search of their souls. Tour guides still tell of some of these seekers. There was the man from Wisconsin who insisted on wandering barefoot through the jungle, drinking river water, and sleeping without a mosquito net. He emerged from his adventure with punctured feet, cramping diarrhea, and bug bites gone septic. There was the self-styled shaman from California who came to sample the sacred drugs the local ayahuasqueras use. He spent most of his time throwing up, and in the end begged to go home. Some tourists keep coming back year after year, but Iquitos feels like a city where no one lives. And in fact, a sizable portion of the population stays only a short time. Teachers, evangelists, aid workers, soldiers, and sailors do their tour of duty and move on. Traffickers in illegal drugs and contraband animals take what they can, get out, come back. No one asks questions, Jamie says. You can get anything you want here. You can be anything you want here. Though it was founded as a Jesuit mission in the 1750s, since the rubber boom, Iquitos has been the nefarious trade capital of the Peruvian jungle. The rubber barons who built their headquarters here were responsible for some of the worst atrocities committed against the rubber tappers. 30,000 Indians were murdered on the Putumayo River, just to the north, sacrificed to the rubber empire of the infamous Julio Cesar Arana. One of his overseers had as his motto, "Kill the fathers first, enjoy the virgins afterwards." Despite its mansions and tiled walls and riverside promenade, even at the height of its wealth, Iquitos harbored few pretensions to grace. Prostitutes filed their teeth razor-sharp like piranhas. On carnival days, section chiefs would toast with champagne the man who boasted of murdering the most Indians that year. Exposing the cruelties of Arana in a series of newspaper articles for a London-based weekly, Walt Hardenberg, a 27-year-old railroad engineer from New York, hastened the end of the Amazon's rubber boom in 1913, inciting worldwide outrage at the atrocities. But today, from this bend in the river 2,300 miles due west of the Atlantic, Iquitos continues to bleed forth the stolen lifeblood of the jungle and its people. Oil, timber, cocaine, animals. Iquitos is still an isolated frontier town. Though it now has radio and telephones, there are still no road links with the world outside. You get here by air or by boat. We had flown from Manaus to the little border town of Tabachinga, where Brazil meets Colombia and Peru, and where we'd stayed at the tiny Hotel Cristiana in a room swarming with mosquitoes. There were no hooks for mosquito nets, and its blue-painted cement walls were impenetrable to the thumbtacks Diane had brought for such an emergency. We determined the mosquitoes were attracted to the lidless, seatless toilet in a doorless, low-lying corner of the room, which was surrounded by a small pond of leaking water. "You would insist we come during the wet season," Diane said. "It's high water even in our room." We'd set out at 4:30 that morning on the 20-seat boat, the Loreto Hapido, so named because the boat's 230-horsepower diesel engine permits travel at the impressive pace of 40 miles per hour, arriving in Iquitos 10 hours later. We had come here to meet Moises Chavez, who works for a friend of mine, Paul Beaver. With business partner Susie Faggard, Paul runs the only lodge in the area, on the edge of the 800,000-acre Tamsiaku Tawayo Community Reserve on the Tawayo River, a day's travel from Iquitos. The reserve and its surrounding area were astonishingly rich in wildlife, with more species of primates, 14, and rodents, 26, than any other area in South America. And there were plenty of dolphins, Paul had promised. He generously offered his lodge as our base and arranged for Moises to act as our guide. Moises met us at the garden of our cozy hotel, La Pascana, in Iquitos. A small, strong man of 38, with wide, high cheekbones and a voice soft as wet leaf litter, Moises' dark, dreamy eyes always seemed to be looking past you, as if scanning the forest for a particular tree and fruit or a troop of monkeys or the cryptic form of a sleeping sloth. His father had been a teacher, whom the government sent to isolated tribes. With his 7 brothers and 4 sisters, Moises grew up learning about the jungle from the Indians on the Napo River, the Yaguas, who decorate their faces daily with elaborate red designs and dress in grass skirts, and the Sequoias, who pierce their bodies and hang their fishhooks conveniently from holes in the nose. In Iquitos, many years ago, before the Belén market was built, Indians lived here on the bank of the river, Moises told us. What happened was many young girls and young men celebrated on Saturdays, but it got out of control. Everyone's gonna drink beer. The dolphin watched this for 1 year. And when this one girl comes to the river, that dolphin, he's gonna watch her. But she doesn't know. Some people say the dolphin's just a dolphin, but the Indian people, they know a different story. Moises knows the stories well. He's heard dozens of them over and over, from his father, from his grandmother, from his Yagua and Sequoia friends. The beginnings of the stories are always long and convoluted, like the meandering canals of the Amazon, and his sentences, like the waterways, crisscross one another, weaving past and future, germane and incidental. He recites with almost poetic cadence. He recites them trance-like, with a faraway look in his dark eyes, as if seeing his way back in time. One day, a day like today, they're gonna celebrate a really big party, Moises told us. One day, an orchestra from Iquitos was going to play. That night, when everyone was drinking and dancing, a handsome man with white skin and blue eyes showed up. The beautiful girl asked the young man to dance. "I've never seen you before," she said. "Where's your home?" He said, "I live here. I saw you one time when you swam by the beach near Iquitos." But the girl, said Moises, had never seen him. She quickly fell in love with the stranger, and that very night he asked her to marry him. "I will give you a present," he said, "a gold watch. My father is a rich man, and I have many gold items at home. I will invite you to my house some day." And that night, along with the gold watch, he gave her a fine diamond and a gold ring. She was very happy, but the young man warned her not to show her new gifts to her mother or brothers or father. "Hide them," he said. "They will be good luck for you." Till 2:30 in the morning they danced, Moises told us. They planned to meet the next week at the next dance. They said goodbye, and he disappeared. But the greedy girl couldn't resist boasting to her parents, her brothers, and all her friends about a rich new boyfriend, and all of them showed up at the dance looking to meet him. Then, said Moises, about 3 o'clock in the morning, they tried to restrain him, but he disappeared. One of the men heard a big splash in the river, but no one thought anything of it. The next week, the stranger returned to the party, seeking the girl. This time he brought her beautiful clothes with gold buttons, beautiful shoes, a golden necklace. They would be married soon, he said. Again he begged her, "Please don't tell your family or girlfriends." But she told everyone in Iquitos she would soon be married to a rich man. And the dolphin knew, said Moises, because the spirit of the dolphin was always watching her. The next week, the stranger returned, sad and angry. He told her, "I'm very sad. This is the last day I will ever see you." And with that, he jumped into the water and disappeared. At that instant, her beautiful shoes turned into big armored catfish. Her ring turned into a leech. Her watch turned into a crab and crawled away. Her necklace became an anaconda. She screamed and cried, but didn't want to tell anyone what had happened, Moises said softly. 3 months later, she's in the hospital. She's gone crazy. And the people saw there were hundreds of dolphins in the water by the river. My grandmother told me this when we lived in the Napo River with the Yagua Indians, said Moises. So I know this is true. Carefully, Moises reviewed our gear for the trip upriver. He found one item conspicuously missing. Even though we both had headlamps and strong little flashlights, he insisted we would need a set of giant flashlights in case we became lost in the jungle at night. In pursuit of these, we set off together for the market at Belém. Its stalls are arrayed along the sloping street that spills down to the river and its drowning shantytown. Little booths no wider than a card table offer cigarettes and cassette tapes, socks and hammocks, lace and fishhooks. On the outskirts of Belém, where the average family includes 9 children, a month's supply of birth control pills goes for the equivalent of 50 cents, the cost of 3 packs of giant bobby pins from China at an adjoining stall. Mingled with American drugstore fare was the produce of the jungle. Piles of dried frogs and fish, the bleached white shells of giant armadillos, the teeth of piranhas, strange fruits with luscious names and sensuous shapes. This large leguminous inga tastes like a guava, Moises explains. This zapote like an orange. The strawberry-shaped piayo is the fruit of a palm, whose peach pit-sized seeds can be roasted like cashews. The air was thick with the smell of roasting flesh. On charcoal grills, the scaly heads and feet of river crocodiles called caimans were cooking, and the hocks of peccaries, and shish kebabs of tiny Andean swifts, their little bills and feet burning black on wooden skewers. One stall sold giant Amazonian snails with shells bigger than a man's fist. A soup made from them, Moises told us, would cure tuberculosis. An old man in the neighboring stall was selling bottles of fermented honey. Moises explained there are 10 different kinds of bees in the jungle, but only one produces the honey from which this elixir is made. A shaman must bury the honey in the ground for several weeks, then mix it with various barks and saps. This produces a medicine good for arthritis and for young women whose wombs are cold. Even in the city, even the most westernized shop owners and hoteliers and restaurateurs still look to the jungle for its magic. There's hardly a businessman in Iquitos who doesn't keep a boa constrictor's head somewhere on the premises, or a jar of dolphin grease, he told us, for it's believed these items will attract money and women. In fact, sometimes the charms work too well. Moises told us of a man he knew named Antonio, who learned from a type of shaman called a banco how to make potions and enchant charms. Antonio had collected half a bottle of dolphin fat and smeared it on his hands. It said that any girl you touch will then find you irresistible. I saw this work great, Moises said. Women swirled around Antonio, and finally the dolphin grease enchanted the most beautiful one of all. Within 3 months, Antonio made her his wife. But one day, Antonio went away on business. He returned to find his wife had left him. Moises remembers his friend's anguish. He talked in his sleep, calling for his lost love. Eventually, Antonio sought another shaman's help, and he found out why his wife had left. She'd come across the dolphin potion, not knowing what it was. Picking up the greasy jar, she'd unwittingly smeared some on her hand. She had been unable to resist the very next man she saw. "You see," Moises said, "dolphin's power is not always under your control." Then I felt Diane's hand on my arm. "Oh, my God," sigh. She was staring at a short, dark woman in a pink dress. Clinging to her shoulder was a baby pygmy marmoset, the world's tiniest New World primate, a minute, wide-eyed sprite. Its body, not including the ringed black and tawny tail, stretched less than 4 inches long. It is an infinitesimal monkey version of a Pekingese. With its large round head, pug nose, and big eyes, a pygmy marmoset is the incarnation of adorable. We had hoped to see one in the wild. They live in groups of 7 to 9 individuals, communicating with one another in high-pitched trills, warning whistles, and clicking threats. They sleep in tree holes at night. By day, they drink tree sap, and with tiny, dexterous orange hands, capture insects and spiders and pluck fruits and buds. Male and female mate for life and are devoted parents. The father actually assists the mother when she gives birth. He receives and cleans the babies, usually twins, who, like us, are born hairless and helpless. Babies first cling to a parent's belly, and later ride like jockeys on the back. To procure the infant on this woman's shoulder, someone had shot both of its parents. Its sibling had probably also died. Next to the woman, a black-faced young woolly monkey clutched a man's hair. A titi monkey, head swiveling in alarm, clung to another vendor's arm. I had seen titis at zoos. They sit with their flexible tails entwined with a mate's or a friend's. At a stall where 20 men were playing cards, one wore a baby white-fronted capuchin monkey like a bracelet. The terrified infant gripped him tight with all the force of its human-like hands, feet, and prehensile tail, but still screamed with every motion of his captor's wrist. These monkeys had almost certainly been obtained in the same way as the marmoset. The parents had been shot, so the babies could be sold here today. In cages we found yellow-cheeked parrots, canary-winged parakeets, and more tiny primates, saddleback and black-mantled tamarins, all endangered species. 2 baby caimans, 2 hard-shelled water tortoises, and 2 more tamarins were packed into a 1 by 1.5 foot square cage with a baby agouti, an aquatic rodent with a pig-like body and a rabbit-like head. The tiny tamarins clutched each other like frightened children. They tore at Diane's heart. Once, when she had worked as a keeper at the Fresno Zoo, she and her husband Pepper had raised 2 infant tamarins whose mother, for some reason, could not nurse them. Both had been charmed by the creature's agility, their inquisitiveness, and their constant chatter to one another as they raced about the couple's house, climbing the curtains, leaping from lampshades, and what surely looked like exuberant joy. Do tamarins feel joy? I'm sure of it, said Diane. Being a tamarin must be a rush. Atop the cage, another tamarin and a squirrel monkey were tethered by their waists with dirty string. CITES Appendix 1, Diane said with gritted teeth. She was speaking of the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species, which she has repeatedly attended. Yearly, this convention, of which Peru is a signatory, convenes its delegates to decide upon the species of animals that need protection from commercial exploitation. Except for the agouti, the sale of every species we had seen was strictly prohibited by international law. A white police truck was parked not 20 yards away, but no one seemed concerned. The police do not interfere in such matters. In Iquitos, the officers tend to reserve their attentions for endeavors more lucrative. The desperately rare tamarins were priced at 15 soles each, less than $5. The marmoset for about $6. I mourned the slain father marmoset who had meticulously cleaned his now stolen infant, the titi monkey who should be twining his tail around a mate's, the tortoises who might otherwise live 20 or 30 or 40, perhaps even 80 years. But to the people selling these animals, their lives mattered not at all. What mattered to them was the handful of soles. Feeling sick, we headed back to our hotel. As we left, we passed a woman who was lying on her back on the table of her little stall, her face aglow with rapture. Her hands were occupied and her eyes focused upon something we couldn't see because a curtain of leather belts was in the way. We assumed she was playing with a baby. We rounded a bend to see the object of her delight. She was counting coins, dropping one after another upon her belly, savoring each metallic clink. I remembered Moises' story of the boastful girl whose gold watch became a crab. I wished the coins could transform themselves back into animals and, like the crab, crawl away. Though there are no dolphins in Iquitos underwater city, we found one in the center of the municipal square. On the Plaza de Armas, a bright pink 8-foot fiberglass sculpture springs from the center of a round reflecting pool perched atop a 3-tiered fountain spewing water onto the litter below. The dolphin statue points its snout at a 30-degree angle toward the sky, its big flippers spread like wings. Diane observed it looked like an aquatic Peter Pan about to take flight. The dolphin statue materialized from a dream. Roxanne Kramer, a former mineral trader from California in her late 40s, says a vision of a pink dolphin atop the fountain came to her in her sleep one night in 1987. She believes dreams are important. "I set about transforming this dream into reality," she told us. Friends made a mold of the dolphin in her Rosemead backyard and had it shipped air freight to Iquitos in 1988. The statue is as much a monument to her crusade as to the species. She told us her story when we met her in Miami the year before. Roxanne first encountered pink dolphins on a mineral and crystal collecting trip along the Arapa River, the first tributary of the Marañón. As the dolphins approached her canoe, she said, she began to hyperventilate with excitement. "I saw this pink cloud under the blackish water. There were 4 or 5 dolphins around my boat. They looked like a huge nude human, like a mermaid, and they started to communicate with me." She'd been warned not to put her hands in the water, but she couldn't resist. She beat her hands on the side of the canoe and was rewarded by the dolphins' hissing spouts. She didn't want to leave them that afternoon, but her guide insisted, warning that the dolphins could come and take her away to their enchanted city if she stayed the night on the river. As she left, she said, a huge rainbow spread itself across the sky, and that night, from her lodge, she heard the cough-like spouting of their breath, as if calling her back. "The dolphins struck a deep chord in me that transcends kinship," she had told us. "They say the dolphins steal you away, and they did. They didn't take me physically, but they did transform the course of my life." That moment launched a crusade that Roxanne has pursued for the past 15 years, a crusade to save the pink dolphins. Roxanne was convinced the pink dolphins were in great danger. Her guide, she said, had told her that people poisoned them, dropped dynamite in their waters, sewed up their blowholes, sold their parts for magic charms. She decided the dolphins needed her help. So she abandoned her mineral business, returned to the Rio Yarapa, and founded the International Society for the Preservation of the Tropical Rainforest, whose first project was preservation of the Amazonian River Dolphin. She bought 1,000 acres of land along the Arapa and declared it a dolphin preserve. She set up a free health clinic for local people. She organized an International Dedication Day of the Dolphin and Ecology in Iquitos, with marching bands, parades, and art contests for children, still a yearly event. She erected the dolphin statue in the plaza. Today, she lobbies for tougher laws and stiffer sentences for animal and skin smugglers. At her Yarapa Lodge, she takes in orphaned and injured monkeys and birds, and once a confiscated jaguar, and there operates an ecotourism venture, Pink Amazon River Dolphin Expeditions, to raise international awareness of the dolphin's plight, as well as raise money to finance her conservation work. In Miami, where she was staying with a friend before departing for Iquitos again, Roxanne bubbled over like the dolphin fountain, outlining her accomplishments and what she intends to do next. She'd like to expand the preserve in her ecotourism operation, hosting scientific and conservation conferences there. She wants to pay guards and crack down on commercial fishermen who seine the river with their huge nets. International Wildlife magazine then had a profile on her in press. Film companies wanted to make documentaries on her work. Her dramatic flair, I could see, would make her a charismatic documentary character. She has mastered the art of speaking in sound bites, tells wonderful stories, and dresses for the camera. The day we met her, she was heading to the airport wearing a plunging jungle print blouse, a tight khaki miniskirt, high-heeled sandals, lots of Peruvian jewelry, and lots of makeup, almost a caricature of the woman jungle explorer. Though she had grown round with the years, she's still an attractive woman. She says the local Indians consider her someone right out of their legends, she said, of blonde-haired goddesses. But the problem with all this is that I've encountered no one who shares Roxanne's view of the pink dolphin's peril. They are common over an enormous range. Vera and her students have extensively investigated Roxanne's claims that the dolphins are tortured and hunted. Vera stated unequivocally that this is not true. Vera explained that catching a dolphin destroys a valuable fishing net. You will never find dolphin meat in the market. No one eats it. And though the animal's fat, eyes, particularly the left eye, and genitalia are sometimes sold as magic charms to attract money in the opposite sex, they are sold cheap. Most of the price comes from the cost of the shaman who casts the spell on the charm, not for the eye itself. The parts sold in the marketplace are, Vera's investigations found, taken only from animals found dead. Males who have died of wounds sustained while fighting, animals who have drowned in fishing nets they raid, or dolphins who died from some other cause. Most fishermen are afraid to kill dolphins, for they fear magical retribution. Though her organization's brochures tout Roxanne's studies of dolphins, scientists we spoke with said they found her fieldwork of questionable value. Roxanne plays music to the dolphins near her camp on an underwater speaker and then studies the response. They particularly like Pink Floyd, she told me. Vera, too, has played various sounds to her study animals. I played Magnificat. I played Rolling Stones. I played the Atlantic bottlenose dolphin. The response was the same, she told us. They're curious about these sounds, so they come to the surface. We should not mix up things, Vera told me. I like Pink Floyd, but I don't need to assume that they like it. Roxanne and her work are controversial. Roxanne works from a more spiritual perspective than do most scientists. Articles about her get published in New Age newsletters like Earth Star, the sort of publication scientists often dislike. But even among non-scientists in the animal protection community, Roxanne has made enemies. Still, I liked Roxanne. She seemed sincere, and her cause, even if not urgent, was just. Diane and I both joined her organization for $35, though we were never mailed a newsletter. Later, Roxanne told me her secretary, a woman she hired because she felt sorry for her, was suffering from emotional problems and simply hadn't done the mailings. During our meeting in Miami, Roxanne had urged us to visit her at her camp, Dolphin Corners, on the Yurapa, for which she had prepared an impressive brochure, and we considered doing so. But she was not in the country during our visit that spring. Diane and I promised to stop by her camp anyway and drop off some medical and veterinary supplies with the resident manager. I found Roxanne's story deeply touching. To finance her project, she had sold her grandfather's land and her grandmother's house in Wisconsin, and in one of our many long phone conversations, she mentioned that she was $56,000 in debt for the project. But the dolphins were more than worth it, she assured. Dolphins are the highest beings on the planet, for sure, she said. She loves the dolphins. She believes in them. She needs them. By her own admission, the pink dolphins have seduced her. It may be that, in the shadowy underworld of Iquitos, where, as Jamie said, you can be anything you want, she's allowed herself to become the golden-haired goddess of local legend. And the shape-shifting dolphins have let her. She's become the savior of a people and a species which perhaps do not need her. Perhaps she's a victim of the same seduction to which so many evangelists and aid workers fall prey, allowing yourself to believe that those you love also love and need you back. Roxanne tells a story that many in Iquitos consider apocryphal. One day, when she was swimming in the Rio Yurapa, she saw a form in the water that she didn't recognize. She says it was a 2-meter bull shark headed straight toward her. She says that out of nowhere, a group of pink dolphins appeared and fought it off, while others used their snouts to push her to her boat in safety. I think, she says, they were trying to thank me. The morning we left Iquitos for the jungle, it was raining again. A man rain, Moises said, which would be short and violent and done in a few hours. I was cold and crabby. I had a sore throat from having been soaked by the rain that had dripped for 8 hours down my sleeve through the plastic-coated windows on the Hopito boat 3 days before. Diane had chosen the aisle seat so she could get up to smoke in the latrine in the back, perched atop the drum carrying the boat's supply of extra diesel. As we landed our gear in our thatched roof, tarp-shrouded boat, the Watson, which would carry us on our day-long journey upriver, I could hardly croak hello to our fellow passengers. Piloting the boat was Mario Wanakiri, a handsome young man with straight black hair, Indian features, and teeth outlined in gold work. He'd already married twice, Moises said. Maybe he had some dolphin grease. Diane and I christened him Super Mario after the video game. Thereafter, we cried out, "Super Mario!" with great enthusiasm every time we saw him, upon which he would break into his great golden smile. Stephen Nordlinger, 31, was a quick, wiry man who worked as a crisis counselor at a Florida clinic. "Your name is Sai?" he asked me with great interest. "That's a kind of Okinawan fighting staff." Steve, we discovered, is an expert in the Oriental martial arts, who gets together with other guys to fight the way others gather at friends' houses for dinner parties. He had spent the summer between high school and college working as a security guard at an amusement park in Massachusetts. He'd slept in the bucket of the Ferris wheel, and by night, dressed in black, patrolled the grounds for prowlers with the Okinawan fighting sticks called nunchaku. His stories were so fantastic that Diane and I were initially skeptical, until the first time we saw his hand dart out to catch an inch-long beetle he wanted to examine. Faster than a snake can strike, he pinned it with breathtaking precision, its thorax held securely but harmlessly between his thumb and forefinger. From then on, we knew everything he told us was true. Steve had gone to the Amazon the previous year with his mother, an intrepid woman who sometimes picks up roadside scorpions and tarantulas on her travels out west and mails them to her son the way other mothers mail their children chocolate chip cookies. On this second trip, he planned to continue his studies and drawings of Amazonian ants, spiders, and insects, and to practice his Spanish. Jerry Kaczynski, 40, was a personal fitness trainer, tall, blonde, and muscled. While in Peru, he was going survival camping in the jungle. With his guide, Rudy Flores, a 25-year-old with dancing brown eyes and excellent English, Jerry was going to build his own raft to travel down the river and explore the forest. But Jerry was a surprise, too. He was not a macho musclehead. He was particularly interested in alternative healing, which he was going to go study in China on a trip the following fall. His calling card has two weightlifters with his name and address on the front, and on the back, "The Way to Happiness. Keep your heart free from hate, your mind from worry. Live simply, expect little, give much. Fill your life with love. Scatter sunshine. Forget self, think of others. Do as you would be done by." Jerry had already had an adventure, he told us. He'd gone dancing at one of the discos in Iquitos the night before, and there he had met the Piranha Woman. He'd only wanted to dance with her, and was looking for nothing more. They'd been having a perfectly fine time, he said, communicating in snippets of English and Spanish, when something happened that caused him to end the association. Without warning, she leaned into his neck and bit him. 8 hours later, as we docked beside Paul's impeccable thatched, screened lodge, Iquitos seemed a world away. The lodge is built on stilts, like a treehouse, but instead of among branches this time of year, the building is surrounded by water. The flow of the river follows you even into sleep. The soft gleam of oil lanterns in the dining hall provides the only artificial light. No generator drowns out the dripping call of the sun grebes, the shivering rainy trill of the screech owls, the bubbling notes of the tree frogs, the tail splash of caimans and jumping fish. The ladder-tailed nightjar calls out the name of the place, "Tuwayu! Tuwayu!" Later, when we would canoe through the flooded forest at night and probe the trees with our huge yellow flashlights, Moises would teach us to recognize the orange glow of the bird's eyes. The day's travel seemed to have cleansed Iquitos from our city-sore souls. So had the day's rain cleansed the skies. That night, even with a half moon, the stars seemed brighter than I'd ever seen. The night skies near the equator are quite different from those we see in North America, with stars I did not recognize. A single constellation sprawled across a full quarter of the sky. I thought it must be Draco, thinking only a dragon could be so big. But in the wet world of the Amazon, during the rainy season, the heavens are ruled not by a fire-breathing reptile, but by a water creature. It was Hydra, the water snake. A huge anaconda, many Amazonian tribes believe, is mother of all water creatures. And her allies, I remembered, are the rainbow and the dolphin.